Accession number 19655, reel 3.
Interview with Mrs. Atherton Harrison, reel 2.
It was slightly embarrassing because we'd just been recently married, and our flat in just off Harley Street was full of books on venereal disease, and I used to worry that my grandmother would come and visit us and she would be rather shocked. But there were two films made, as far as I can remember, one for women and one for men. And they were filmed mainly in Marylebone Film Studios, which were a little small film studio on the corner of Marylebone Road and Edgware Road. I think it still exists. But we filmed a great deal of the work there. And I don't remember very much about the venereal disease films. I remember the joke that we all laughed about was that they'd been talking about gonorrhea, and then somebody said, and syphilis? And the cameraman said, who's she? It was rather nice. That's about all I remember about that. Yes.
Who wrote the scripts?
I'm afraid I don't remember. Probably my husband, I should think. He wrote scripts as well. I really only did scripts for... I may have had something... I think I probably had some input into the women's venereal disease. But, I mean, it would have been very modest and very slight, I think. These days we would think it really rather funny.
And these films were intended for service?
They were shown to the troops, yes. And in fact, they used to say that the men's were shown the film, that there would always be one or two who fainted. A little too near the knuckle.
And were there any actual VD cases appearing in the film itself, or were these illustrations?
I don't know. I can't remember. I never saw the men's, because I think it was only four men. I certainly never saw that and didn't have anything to do with it, as far as I can remember. And the women's really was talk. I mean, it wasn't, I don't think there was very much pictorial input.
This was presumably in response to the sudden increase in VD during the war.
Yes, yes. Well, it's the first time that in a way that men and women had worked together in situations which were so different from previous times. I mean, in the First World War, women didn't, I mean, apart from nurses, they didn't really have an active war, did they? It was all a bit difficult.
You mentioned earlier that your husband had not been called up at the start of war and indeed had been advised that he would be needed by the Air Ministry and the Navy. Could you say something about his pre-war career, even though you didn't yet know him then, the fact that he was already working for these two services, and also describe what you consider the quality of the cameraman and the technical staff available to him during the war?
Yes, before I met him, of course, he was working for a company called British Films, who did government propaganda, mainly for the Conservative Party and the national government. And they also made films, instructional films, for the Air Ministry and for the Navy and for the Ministry of Agriculture. So he had a wide knowledge and experience of documentary and instructional films. So when the war started, the Air Ministry and the Navy hadn't really got organized. But they were anxious to keep Harvey's services, and they said, you mustn't take any other job because we are going to fully employ you during the war making instructional films. And so he had to wait 2 or 3 months before it all got started. And then he made Ditching Without Hedging and Service Calling and various other films for the services. He was, of course, director of, as we would say today, director of photography and also a director of film. So he, wherever he could, he liked to photograph a film himself. So often he would just have an assistant cameraman. And, of course, the many of the young men, like Harry Orchard, who worked a great deal with Harvey before the war, and he eventually was called up in the RAF and wasn't a pilot, he was an observer, I think.
He worked as a film unit cameraman in the RAF film production unit.
Yes, he did. But he also became a member of the crew of a fighter,
yes,
pilot. And he had been trained as a cameraman by my husband. And we were very close to Harry. I knew him for years and years. He's dead now. And so he worked as an assistant with Harvey until he was called up. And then some of the other cameramen that Harvey worked with during the war were, of course, older men who were not being called up for the services and who perhaps were not the top flight of cameramen, but were very adequate for assisting Harvey, who liked to keep his eye on the camera, as one might say. There was Jack Rose, who was an older cameraman who did several films, including Service Calling with Harvey. And then there was D.P. Cooper, who was quite elderly, and he worked on the Duties of a Lookout, the naval film that Harvey filmed on the Kelly with Mountbatten. And there were many other films. And then towards the end of the war, he did one for the Admiralty called Oiling at Sea. And he had already made films for the British Oxygen Company, and the manager of the British Oxygen Company depot just off Harley Street was Jimmy Juby, who became a great friend and who also worked with Harvey on Oiling at Sea, which meant that they went up on a minesweeper up the west coast of Scotland towards the end of the war, and where it was still quite heavily mined. And then he did a lot of medical films towards the at the end of the war. He got quite a name for doing that. And then, of course, his big picture was the Operation Grapple, the Christmas Island Pacific H-bomb tests in 1957.
Will you describe Operation Grapple in as much detail as possible, how he was chosen, what he told you about the experience?
Yes, indeed. Well, the film had started to tell the story of Operation Grapple, and it began with the build-up of all the machinery and equipment that had to be got together and taken out Christmas Island. And that part of the film was directed by somebody called George. I don't know his Christian name. And then when the unit went out to Christmas Island for the actual drop, then Harvey took over the direction and the photography. And he had, as an assistant cameraman, Chris Bourne, and a small unit of only about four or five people altogether. It was a very tough assignment because there was an awful lot to film. He had to show the build-up and the arrangements that were being made for the explosion. He was one of the few men on the whole site who knew the whole story. The pilot never saw the bomb. And so there was an enormous story to photograph before the actual drop. And Christmas Island was taken over by the services, of course, and the native population, it wasn't very large, but they were moved to other islands further south, I think. And Harvey tried to make a picture of the terrain of the island, which was incredibly bleak and horrible, really. And there was very little comfort. They were in tents. There were land crabs. Harvey had one that lived under his bed. They were horrible animals with enormous claw. And there was absolutely no sophistication or comfort, and the food was awful, and Harvey put up with it for some months and found it pretty unpleasant, I think, but was determined to do a good job, which he did. And he felt very strongly that it was the nuclear bomb was a powerful piece. He felt that nobody who knew had any idea what it was like would ever consider. And to a certain extent, he has been proved right, hasn't he? But it was a very tough assignment, and one of the things he told me was that they went on to another island. This was just before the drop, two or three days before, and they wanted to film, I think, the last of the people going from this particular island. And as the last ship left, Harvey and his unit of two or three men, were left on the island until the next day. They couldn't be picked up until the next day. So they just had to sort of sit on the island. And in the morning, they went looking. There had been a few tents and things left, I think. And they went looking for something to eat, and all they could find was pickled onions and beer. Wasn't a very nice breakfast. But it was a terribly dangerous episode, because Harvey said that at the drop, Harvey was on a Royal Naval ship. HMS Warrior was out there, and Harvey had a cabin on HMS Warrior. He said it was the only time when he was comfortable at all. And then there was also HMS Narvik, and I don't know which one he was on at the drop. But they all had to turn their backs, as if that was going to do any good, and have very, very dark goggles, absolutely black, because he brought a pair home, and put their hands over their eyes. And he said that when the explosion happened, Harvey could see the bones on his fingers, rather like an X-ray. And, of course, a greater number of men who were there have died of cancer, including my husband. But I have to say that it wasn't deliberate. It was ignorance. They didn't know what they were doing. And so you can't really blame anybody. But I think it was an ill-thought-out episode altogether.
What awareness was there, did your husband have, of the health risks?
Well, I think he was aware that it wasn't as safe as they were pretending it was. I don't know, but perhaps it's unfair to say pretending. I think there was an enormous amount of ignorance of what was happening. And I think it's true to say that nobody realized the real danger. But whether the scientists did know or didn't know what they were unleashing, I don't know. Then there were many minor films that he made after Grapple.
Before we go on to talking about those other films, when your husband came back from Christmas Island, did he explain any of his anxieties about the film, or was it an assignment like another that he would describe without any...
I think he was pleased with his part of it. He felt that it had... I mean, always when he made films, he was very sort of definite about whether he felt it had worked and it had been as successful as he'd hoped, and like Service Calling, where he felt that it was not a success, he would say so, and hope that another time he would do better. I think he was a very, very skilled filmmaker, and a very honest man too. Liked to do the best job he could. And then a very successful film that he made was, now if I get this title right, is, can I look at the list of things, because it's a sort of title that doesn't come easily. The Thin Film Circuits for Microminiaturization. How's that? That was made for Mullards, the Valve people, and it won first prize at Venice Film Festival in 1965. So that he always felt that it was an instructional film, but it went very well. He always felt that it was a good film. And then, of course, he did it after the war. All these films on the Valiant, the B-bombers, which the Victor, the Vulcan, and the Valiant.
And presumably these led out from his wartime work.
Yes.
Well, being a reliable director for the Air Ministry.
Yes, and I mean, he'd done it before the war and during the war and afterwards. So, and when you see that, how many films there are here on this list... And that's only some of them. So he was a very experienced man.
Did he ever wish that he had made other films, branched out into another area than instructional,
yes, I think
vaguely scientific and service-related? As well.
I think he would love to have made more artistic films, and he was an artist, he wasn't a scientist, and in some ways he was a very peaceful, sensitive man, and it was really rather strange that he got involved with these scientific and war-type films, because he was not that sort of man at all. And I don't think he found it very easy. But he had to make a living. And those, he was good at that, doing that sort of film. But I don't think it was what he would really have liked to have done if he had had the opportunity. And I mean, now there are opportunities, because of television mainly, to do more artistic films and nature films and that kind of thing. He would love to have done and would have been very good at. But there wasn't the opportunity in those days. Television had hardly came before he died, not in the quantities it requires now.
But he had his own company, and presumably that company had that profile, and so it was a bit of a circle that
it was difficult to get out of. And although he had his own company, he had to make sponsored films. He couldn't. He hadn't the capital to do the films himself. We did do one or two little ones. We did a charming little film on homemade wine, which was. We did several little films for women's institutes and organisations like that. But
in the 1960s.
In the 1960s, yes. And 70s, and of course one of the ones that we both enjoyed enormously was Fame and Fashion, which was sponsored by Paul Easter Bush, who had a collection of costume, which she wanted to make a film about, and I wrote the script and worked with Harvey on it, and it really is a delightful little film, which is very popular with women's institutes and organisations of that sort, and then eventually was updated by the National Trust, which my son did for them, to bring it to include the National Trust collection of costume at Killerton. And that was the sort of film that he would like to have made more of, if the opportunity had been available, as it is much more now.
Could you say anything about his work with, or his involvement in trade union, in the cinema trade union activity?
No, he was, I think you could say that he was a little anti-union, and of course, I think something that had perhaps been a bit difficult for him was that his work for a good many years for British Films had given his politics the wrong colour, perhaps, because they were making conservative and unionist films.
Were these his politics, or were they his job?
Yes, they were. Yes. He was more right-wing than left-wing. And so perhaps for the film industry of that time, his politics were not...
Perhaps be what separates him slightly from Paul Rother and Grierson?
I think so, yes.
And so during the war time, when one customarily thinks of the documentary filmmakers...
Yes, you think
together.
Left. Yes, I think perhaps that's so. But I don't think it made all that much difference. Not really. But it didn't make any difference in the services, for instance.
But then, post-war, presumably, he had to use union camera?
Yes, there was a time, of course, when the ACT was very strict about that. But he had been, he had one of the earliest numbers in the union. He had been an ACT member from his very earliest days of the union. And so he said, it was something you had to do in those days.
Presumably your husband worked on a certain number of confidential films when he was doing work for the services.
Yes, indeed. And of course Operation Grapple at that time was very secret, and it was banned from being shown, and it was something that Harvey had to live with for quite a time, because people would ask questions like how far away were you from the explosion, that kind of thing, which he always refused to answer. I've heard him many times say, I can't answer that. And then the only other film that I know that was quite classified was Maritime Electronic Warfare. And my stepson, Harvey's eldest son, was in the Canadian Navy at that time. And when he realized what his father was doing, he couldn't believe it, because it was so secret, apparently. And many, many years later, my son, who had the same name as his father, Harvey Harrison, was with a film unit, and they were going to Russia or somewhere behind the Iron Curtain. And all the film unit got visas, but Harvey, at the age of about 18, was refused, and we couldn't think why. And then we realized that because he had the same name as his father, he'd probably been mixed up. And he always felt that Harvey had was on a list somewhere for having done so many of these highly confidential films.
You mentioned your son. Could you say something very briefly about his own distinguished career?
Well, yes, indeed. I'm very proud of him. He has done remarkably well as a director of photography.
He was trained by your husband?
Yes, originally he had a year's working with his father, which was a very, very tough assignment. I can remember we went on location, and Harvey had to load the van with all the equipment and things, and betide him if he left something behind, and if he was slow in getting out the tape, you know, where's that bloody tape? And so he really, and he says now that it stood him in very good stead. And then he went through all the cameramans from Tapas loader and a focus puller and an assistant cameraman. And now, of course, he's director of photography and has done such films as Cast Away and Golden Eye and 101 Dalmatians. He prefers being the director of photography on the second unit, because he's got quite a name for special effects. And he's just done The Mummy, the second unit on that, and did all these amazing effects. And of course with GoldenEye he did the famous tank chase, which was exciting, and he has a sort of reputation for doing that kind of work. He prefers that to doing the artists in the studio. He likes being on location and doing exciting things, so one is very proud of him. And he's been the president of the British Society of Cinematographers. Right?
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, sir.